experience for you. Please mark in your songbooks as our song of invitation, number 802. We'll sing that after our lesson this morning. And after you've marked number 802, let's begin our lesson in James chapter 4. I appreciate the song that Ryan selected before our lesson this morning, as it mirrors James chapter 4, beginning in verse 7. Submit therefore to God, James writes, resist the devil and he will flee from you. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be miserable and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned into mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord, and He will exalt you. And yet that's not the message that our society sends to us. It is a Super Bowl today. We are all aware of that, I'm sure. And most of us are more excited about the commercials than about the game itself. I mean, who really cares about Patriots and Falcons, right? Unless you're a Patriots and Falcons fan, in which case the Cardinals are always looking for new fans. But with all the Super Bowl ads going on today, it got me thinking about advertising and what the ads are trying to tell us about culture, about ourselves, and about the image that we see ourselves. There was one ad that I saw recently that got me thinking. It's an ad for Cool Sculpting, which is a cosmetic procedure. And the series of ads involve individuals walking through their normal lives, whether it's at the mall or walking down the street. And life is surrounded with mirrors. And the tagline for the ad is, fear no mirror. Now, it's all about self-image. It's about having the kind of body image to where you're not afraid of seeing an image of yourself everywhere you go, reflected in buildings and reflected on this and reflected on that, and yes, even reflected in your own mind or on your cell phone when you're taking a picture of yourself. And while it's important to have a good body image, and I don't think that there's anything inherently sinful about having a healthy body image, we need to be very, very careful that we don't become so obsessed with ourselves that we elevate self to the level of God. Now, perhaps more than any other time period in human history, we are aware of our image. We are aware of what we look like. And it's because of all the mirrors that surround us. It was only a few hundred years ago that mirrors became really commonplace. So they've existed for thousands of years. Some archaeologists believe that mirrors they've discovered have dated back to 3000 BC. But of course, those were luxury items, and very few people got to see themselves reflected in a mirror like that. Now we see images of ourselves everywhere. They're reflected back to us on every glossy surface in our lives. And you might like how you look. You might hate how you look. Either way, there are so many mirrors in our lives today. Now, like I said, we're more aware of our self-image than any previous generation. But even going back as far as 1979, one writer had this to say in a book called The Culture of Narcissism. Now, he wrote it in 1979, but he might as well have written this today. All of us, actors and spectators alike, live surrounded by mirrors. In them we seek reassurance of our capacity to captivate or impress others, anxiously searching out blemishes that might detract from the appearance we intend to project. The advertising industry deliberately encourages this preoccupation with appearances. In the 20s, the 1920s that is, the women in ads were constantly observing themselves, ever self-critical. A noticeable proportion of magazine ads directed at women depicted them looking into mirrors. Ads of the 1920s were quite explicit about this narcissistic imperative. Now, the writer mentions a booklet advertising beauty aids depicted on its cover. There was a nude with the caption, "Your masterpiece, yourself." Today, the treatment of such themes is more explicit than ever. Moreover, advertising encourages men as well as women to see the creation of the self as the highest form of creativity. Now, all of that castigation aside, it's not necessarily wrong to care how you look, or to wear nice clothes, or to take care of your body. Interestingly enough, when you read in Matthew chapter 6 of pretentious false religion, Jesus had this to say beginning in verse 16. Whenever you fast, do not put on a gloomy face as the hypocrites do, for they neglect their appearance in order to be seen fasting by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you fast, and I suppose we could take the same logic and apply it to all our acts of worship. Whenever you worship God, whenever you devote yourself to God, whenever you are disciplining yourself spiritually, anoint your head and wash your face so that you may not be seen fasting by men, but by your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will repay you. So even Jesus would prescribe a tidy, clean appearance as one preventative measure against pretentious religion. Now, while costly garments and gold and expensive jewelry are mentioned in 1 Timothy 2, verse 9, and in 1 Peter 3 and verse 3, let's remember that these are relative terms that Paul and Peter are using to refer to costly garments and expensive this and expensive that. Those are relative terms. What is expensive to you? What is a costly garment to you might not be a costly garment to somebody else. So let's not take 1 Timothy 2 and 1 Peter 3 so literally and to such an extreme that we forget what the intention of the passage is. The intention of the passage is not telling people don't wear certain things, but don't wear certain things to the neglect or exclusion of the rich interior person that needs to be cultivated. That's the point of those passages. And also, biblical precedent indicates that a reasonable degree, emphasis on reasonable degree of cleanliness and fashion are not inherently wrong. We just studied last week from Ruth chapter 3 that when Ruth was encouraged and instructed by Naomi, her mother-in-law, to go to Boaz, she was told to do the best she could with her appearance, to take a bath, to do your hair, to wear your best garments. And we see Ruth as being a very, very noble character in the Bible. I find it hard to believe that we would read out of the story of Ruth something as pretentious and empty and vain as that. Psalm 45, which we don't have time to study this morning, is a beautiful psalm. You might notice the subtitle under Psalm 45 has something, depending on what your translation says, something to do with the marriage feast of the king or the marriage procession of the king. And in that passage, I do want to read just a couple of verses just to take note of what is said here. Within the context of the marriage of the king, verse 3 says, "Gird thy sword on thy thigh, O mighty one, in thy splendor and thy majesty." Now that's pretty impressive raiment if you ask me. Verse 8, "All thy garments are fragrant with myrrh and aloes and cassia." And yet that's never described as being a vain or an empty thing that one's garments would smell like that. Verse 13, "The king's daughter is all glorious within her. Clothing is interwoven with gold. She will be led to the king in embroidered work," it says in verse 14. So within the context of the king's marriage feast, these garments are seen not as inappropriate or vain or superfluous, but is entirely appropriate to the occasion. Luke chapter 15, verse 22, on top of all of that, when the prodigal son returns to his father, what does the father say? He tells his servants to dress the prodigal son in the finest clothes and get him shoes for his feet and get a gold ring and put it on his finger. So if Paul and Peter literally mean that expensive clothes and gold and jewelry are not allowed by God, then we just read several passages that seem to contradict that. These are relative things that we need to keep in mind, and there is nothing inherently or necessarily wrong with looking nice, with looking tidy, and being a clean individual. However, is there a limit to just how glamorous we should be, or how image conscious we should be, or how deep into the world of fashion and fitness and sexiness and self-absorption that we should go? I had to put Miss Piggy up, by the way, because you know a month or two ago I had Kermit the Frog on here. Seemed only appropriate. Of course, she personifies in her own Muppety way exactly what we're talking about today. Your masterpiece, yourself. Out of that quote we read earlier today, I want to fixate upon that message for just a few moments here in our lesson. The Bible is filled with examples of people who saw themselves as the most glorious thing on planet Earth, who saw themselves as the most important thing on planet Earth, who saw themselves as the pinnacle and the peak of human beauty and human glory and honor and wealth and, yes, intellect and wisdom. Solomon, for example, has this to say in his own words in Ecclesiastes chapter 1. He sums up the pursuit of his life in Ecclesiastes 1, beginning in verse 12. I, the preacher, Solomon, writing about himself here, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task, he says. Verse 14, I've seen all the works which have been done under the heaven, and behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. Maybe you could also include in there that no matter how hard you try to change your appearance, you are always you. Think about that for a sec, my friends. What is straightened cannot be made crooked. What is crooked cannot be straightened out. You are always you. And you can put costly garments on yourself. And you can surround yourself with the most expensive things. And you can be vain and superfluous. But you are still you. And at the end of the day, your soul, not your body, not your look, not your image, your soul must face God. You are still you. But he goes on to say of all of his accomplishments in verse 16, behold, I said to myself, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. And my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. I set my mind to know wisdom, to know madness and folly. I realize that this also is striving after the wind, because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. And he goes on to describe his life of luxury and beauty in chapter 2. And of that life of luxury, he says, I came to hate it, verses 18 and 19. I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. That's a life, when you read in chapter 2, by the way, of all the things that he had, his possessions and his homes and the beautiful people that surrounded him. That's a life that many people in our culture would envy. And yet Solomon comes to the conclusion that it was empty, that it was a waste. Go to the book of Daniel now. Especially here in Daniel chapter 5. Now in Daniel chapter 5, remember the context here. Belshazzar, who comes after King Nebuchadnezzar around the year 538 BC, has taken the pieces or the implements, the gold chalice, for example, other implements that were used in the temple in Jerusalem that had been taken to Babylon, and he takes those implements and he begins to have a party with them, and they're drinking out of them, and they're playing with them, and he and his Babylonian consorts are having a good time. And handwriting appears on his wall, and it frightens him and everybody around him. So they bring Daniel in. Daniel is the only one, possibly, who could know what this is about. And this is what Daniel has to say, both of Belshazzar himself and of Nebuchadnezzar at one point in his life. Begin reading here in verse 17. Keep your gifts for yourself, Daniel tells Belshazzar, or give your rewards to someone else. However, I will read the inscription to the king and make the interpretation known to him. O king, the most high God granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty to Nebuchadnezzar your father. And because of the grandeur which he bestowed on him, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language feared and trembled before him. Whomever he wished, he killed, and whomever he wished, he spared alive, and whomever he wished, he elevated, and whomever he wished, he humbled. And Daniel himself got to experience the full range of those things, didn't he, during the time of Nebuchadnezzar? But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was deposed from his royal throne and his glory was taken away from him. He was driven from mankind and his heart was made like that of beasts. His dwelling place was with the wild donkeys. He was given grass to eat like cattle and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until, look at this, until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind and that he sets it over whomever he wishes. Now that's referring back to chapter 4 in perhaps the most famous case of boanthropy in human history. That is to say, someone who believes that he's a cow. And when Nebuchadnezzar finally recognized that God is Most High and that he is not, he was allowed to return to his life of glory and splendor, a little more humble, a little smaller. And Belshazzar needed to learn the same lesson too, didn't he? Which is why Daniel says in verse 22, "Yet you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all of this. But you have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven, and they've brought the vessels of his house before you. You and your nobles, your wives, and your concubines have been drinking wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or understand. But the God in whose hand your life breath and are your ways, you have not glorified." Nebuchadnezzar learned his lesson the hard way. Did Belshazzar need to learn his lesson the hard way too? Certainly sounds like it, huh? Any time that we exalt ourselves or the work of our hands above God, we are really just exalting mankind, the creature, the creation, above the Creator. Now, it's mentioned in Romans chapter 1, but there's other passages that talk about that as well. In Psalm 115, verses 1 through 8, it speaks of the work of man's hands and the idols that we create for ourselves. And really, when we create idols for ourselves, aren't we just elevating the favorite parts of man? Don't idols become more a reflection of us than anything else? In Acts chapter 17, verse 29, the Apostle Paul says that the divine nature is not like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the thought and intent of man. Or in Isaiah 2, verse 8, it speaks of the way that they worship the work of their hands, that which their fingers have made. But this brings us to the really hard part of the lesson, my friends. The part where we stop talking about Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. The part where we stop talking about things that happened 2,500 years ago. The part where we stop talking about idols as if all they are just little golden statues that people used to make for themselves and now we can point and laugh at how backward they are. No, my friends, this is as alive and well today as it ever has been in human history, if not more so. Look no further than the selfie. I want to make something very, very clear. There is nothing inherently wrong with self-portraiture. And I want to make that so clear because I do take a lot of selfies. So I have to justify myself somehow, don't I? It's not a new problem, by the way. That's why I picked out that great picture there on the left, because I thought it just really summed up the attitude and intent of the selfie throughout the ages. But really, since the very first time that a man saw his reflection in a pool of water and figured out how to scratch his likeness on the side of a cave, we have always had a tendency to be captivated by our own image. We like the way mankind looks. We find mankind attractive, especially the most attractive of us. And it's not the self-portraiture that is the issue. It's not taking a picture when you're in Disneyland and saying, "Hey, look, I was in Disneyland." It's not taking a picture of yourself at the Grand Canyon and saying, "Look, hey, I was at the Grand Canyon." It's not taking a picture of yourself with a new haircut. Looks good today, Doug, by the way. I like it. That's not what it's about. That's not the problem. It's not self-portraiture that's the problem. It's the self in the self-portraiture. It's the self in the selfie. When we see self as the most important being in the world, we have severely lost touch with what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 22, beginning in verse 37, when he was asked, "What is the greatest commandment?" You know what Jesus said? "To love God first and foremost with all your heart and all your soul and all your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And there is no law greater than these. There is no law that supersedes these. There is no law that circumvents these." And if you see yourself as the pinnacle, if you see yourself as the greatest thing, you don't get Matthew 22. You don't get it. And this isn't limited to selfies. I think selfies are maybe a generational thing. And if you're not the sort of person that holds your cell phone out like this to get a picture of yourself everywhere you go, "Hey, I'm an old spaghetti factory," then maybe we need to realize it's not just about taking cell phone pictures. Because the same attitude that motivates us to be obsessed with ourselves and to idolize ourselves on social media like Facebook and Instagram, it is the same attitude that goes into being caught up in what your job title is or what your accomplishments are, or being upset if you didn't get appointed as an elder or a deacon in the local congregation. It's the same attitude that goes into the way that we manipulate our spouses to just get what we want out of a marriage, not to give of ourselves into a marriage, as the Ephesians chapter 5 model indicates. It's the attitude that goes into shoving unrealistic expectations onto your children as if they're nothing but accessories in your life or a reflection of your status, so that if your children aren't as successful as you want them to be, then you never feel as successful as you want to be for yourself as well. Children are not a handbag. Children are not a handbag. They're not an accessory. They're not an extension of you. They are an individual. And if we raise them in the right way, they will be individuals who grow up and accomplish great things for God. And we better hope for that more than anything else. And it's also the same attitude that goes into always needing the latest this or that to feel entirely satisfied. We buy a car and it gets a scratch on it. And suddenly that car that we just bought isn't so glorious or glamorous anymore. We turn a certain age, which really, what is a number? What is a date on a calendar? What is the big difference between 39 and 40, Austin? No, I'm asking, really, because it's not that far away for some of us. You don't have to be a selfie-taking social networker to see the problem of self as idol. It touches all of us and impacts all of us in our own way, if only generationally. But you might ask yourself, is this really such a big deal? Why should I care? What is the big problem? So I like the way I look. So I post a lot of pictures of myself on social media. So I care about fashion, maybe a little bit too much. So I spent way too much money on this or that to feel beautiful and glamorous. So maybe I do walk through my life and look at my reflection in every glossy, reflective surface. What's the problem with that? Well, it's the attitude that goes into 2 Timothy chapter 3. He says here in verse 2 that men will become lovers of self. It's interesting. The verse doesn't stop there, does it? The interesting thing about sin to me is that sin always leads to something else. Sin always becomes something else. Sin doesn't stay in a tidy box. Sin always seeps into other parts of our lives, and it grows and it expands and it touches other relationships. When you become a lover of self, look at the other things that are associated with that, the other things that touch that as well. Men will become lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious gossips without self-control, brutal, haters of good, treacherous, reckless, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, holding to a form of godliness, although they have denied its power, and avoid such men as these. And you know the old saying, boy, that escalated quickly. When you become a lover of self, it begins a cascade reaction in your spiritual life and in your personal life and in your relationships that destroys everything. And that is why I say with great confidence that at the root of every sin, somewhere, there is the seed of selfishness. There is the seed of selfishness. But the second problem that I see is this. And by the way, this is from the same series of advertisements from Cool Sculpting. I put these up here to show that it is not only an advertising campaign directed at women, but at men as well. Don't we care about how we look too? We might not preen ourselves for quite as long in the morning, but we sure do care what the end result looks like. But notice something about these two ads, okay? Notice something here. What direction is everybody facing in these ads? Well, they're certainly not facing forward. In every ad that I looked up, and I Googled the entire series of Fear No Mirror ads, and in every single ad from the series, not a single person is looking forward. That's the thing about yourself. When you are obsessed with yourself, you have a very hard time focusing on the goals that are set before you by God, by family, by marriage. Take selfies, for example. In January 2015, a pair of Russian soldiers died while taking a selfie with a live grenade when it unexpectedly detonated. In August 2015, a man was gored to death while taking a selfie during the running of the bulls in Pamplona, Spain. In April 2014, a woman from North Carolina was killed when her car veered over the center median, collided with a truck, then burst into flames. She was posting selfies only moments before. February 2015, a young man in Washington State took a selfie on a train track, misjudging which track an oncoming train was on. September 2015, a Japanese tourist fell backward down the steps of the Taj Mahal while trying to take a selfie, and eventually died of the injuries sustained. And this is just a few of them. Page after page after page of Google results, if you just search death by selfie. When you're not looking forward, when you're not paying attention to life, when you're fixated on how you look, how you appear to other people, not only are you a danger to others, but you're a danger to yourself as well. And there's a great passage in the book of Proverbs that's up here on the screen that reminds us of that. Go to Proverbs chapter 4. And it says in Proverbs chapter 4, beginning in verse 20, "My son, give attention to my words, incline your ear to my sayings. Do not let them depart from your sight. Keep them in the midst of your heart, for they are life to those who find them and health to all their whole body. Watch over your heart with all diligence, for from it flow the springs of life. Put away from you a deceitful mouth and put devious lips far from you. Let your eyes look directly ahead, and let not your gaze fall to the right or to the left," he says in verse 27. Verse 26, "Watch the path of your feet. All your ways will be established then." When you look at the needs of other people, it's hard to care about how you look that day. When there are people hurting all around you, when there are friends and family members, and yes, even your enemies who suffer the consequences of sin, who live in an unrepentant state, who need to hear the gospel. When you remember that there is either heaven or hell waiting for you on the other side of this life, when you remember that there are Christians every single day who have physical needs and spiritual needs, when you remember that you are the one that God has asked to help them by circumstance or by providence, you're the one who can give them help. Sure, it's hard to worry about what you look like that day, to put self above everything else. Love God first and foremost, and love your neighbor as yourself. And if you've got anything left over after that, then sure. Dress nice. Look nice. Get a haircut. Take a shower. Those things aren't sinful. Those things aren't sinful until they become tools that we use to build up self as an idol. Then it becomes a real problem that will destroy anybody who goes down that path. There's only one mirror that really matters, and it's the mirror that we read about in James chapter 1, which is the Word of God. And some people look at the mirror of the Word of God for a moment and they're affected by it, but as soon as they walk away, they forget what was looking at them. When they've examined themselves by God's standard, they sure feel guilty. They say, yeah, I need to work harder at that. After a lesson like that, sure, Ryan, I've got to work on self-image and self-obsession. Yeah, for sure. But as soon as we walk away from the mirror, we forgot what we looked like. We forgot what the problem was. We forgot what the ugly blemish was. We forgot what needed to be corrected, and we forgot what God prescribed to fix it. Look intently at the Word of God, for it is the only mirror that matters. And if the reflection staring back at you from the Word of God is not a pleasant one, then it's not the Word of God that needs to change. My friends, make that change right now. If you have any spiritual need at all, then I encourage you to please come forward as we stand and sing.